Reform or Revolution by Rosa Luxemburg. Chapter 8. Conquest of Political Power. The fate of democracy is bound up, we have seen, with the fate of the labor movement. But does the development of democracy render superfluous or impossible a proletarian revolution? That is, the conquest of political power by the workers? Bernstein settles the question by weighing minutely the good and bad sides of social reform and social revolution. He does it almost in the same manner in which cinnamon or pepper is weighed out in a consumer's cooperative store. He sees the legislative course of historic development as the action of intelligence, while the revolutionary course of historic development is for him the action of feeling. Reformist activity, he recognizes as a slow method of historic progress, revolution as a rapid method of progress. In legislation, he sees a methodical force, in revolution, a spontaneous force. We have known for a long time that the petty bourgeoisie reformer finds good and bad sides in everything. He nibbles a bit at all grasses. But the real course of events is little affected by such combination. The carefully gathered little pile of the good sides, of all things possible, collapses at the first flip of history. Historically, legislative reform and the revolutionary method function in accordance with influences that are much more profound than the consideration of the advantages or inconveniences of one method or another. In the history of bourgeois society, legislative reform served to strengthen progressively the rising class, till the latter was sufficiently strong to seize political power, to suppress the existing judicial system, and to construct itself a new one. Bernstein, thundering against the conquest of political power as a theory of Blanquist violence, has the misfortune of labeling as a Blanquist error that which has always been the pivot and the motive force of human history. From the first appearance of class societies, having the class struggle as the essential content of their history, the conquest of political power has been the aim of all rising classes. Here is the starting point and end of every historic period. This can be seen in the long struggle of the Latin peasantry against the financiers and nobility of ancient Rome, in the struggle of the medieval nobility against the bishops, and in the struggle of the artisans against the nobles in the cities of the Middle Ages. In modern times, we see it in the struggle of the bourgeoisie against feudalism. Legislative reform and revolution are not different methods of historic development that can be picked out at the pleasure from some counter of history, just as one chooses hot or cold sausages. Legislative reform and revolution are different factors in the development of class society. They condition and complement each other, and are at the same time reciprocally exclusive, as are the North and South Poles, the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. Every legal constitution is the product of a revolution. In the history of classes, revolution is the act of political creation, while legislation is the political expression of the life of a society that has already come into being. Work for reform does not contain its own force independent from revolution. During every historic period, work for reforms is carried on only in the direction given to it by the impetus of the last revolution, and continues as long as the impulsion from the last revolution continues to make itself felt. Or, to put it more concretely, In each historic period, work for reforms is carried on only in the framework of the social form created by the last revolution. Here is the kernel of the problem. It is contrary to history to represent work for reforms as a long drawn out revolution, and revolution as a condensed series of reforms. A social transformation and a legislative reform do not differ according to their duration, but according to their content. The secret of historic change through the utilization of political power resides precisely in the transformation of simple quantitative modification into a new quality, or to speak more concretely, in the passage of an historic period from one given form of society to another. That is why people who pronounce themselves in favor of the method of legislative reform in place and in contradistinction to the conquest of political power and social revolution do not really choose a more tranquil, calmer, and slower road to the same goal, but a different goal. Instead of taking a stand for the establishment of a new society, they take a stand for surface modifications of the old society. If we follow the political conceptions of revisionism, we arrive at the same conclusion that is reached when we follow the economic theories of revisionism. Our program becomes not the realization of socialism, but the reform of capitalism. Not the suppression of the wage-labor system, but the diminution of exploitation, that is, the suppression of the abuses of capitalism, instead of suppression of capitalism itself. Does the reciprocal role of legislative reform and revolution apply only to the class struggle of the past? It is possible that now, as a result of the development of the bourgeois juridical system, the function of moving society from one historic phase to another belongs to legislative reform, and that the conquest of state power by the proletariat has really become, quote, an empty phrase, as Bernstein puts it. The very opposite is true. What distinguishes bourgeois society from other class societies, from ancient society and from the social order of the Middle Ages? Precisely the fact that class domination does not rest on acquired rights, but on real economic relations. The fact that wage labor is not a juridical relation, but purely an economic relation. In our juridical system, there is not a single legal formula for the class domination of today. The few remaining traces of such formulae of class domination are, as that concerning servants, survivals of feudal society. How can wage slavery be suppressed the legislative way, if wage slavery is not expressed in the laws? Bernstein, who would do away with capitalism by means of legislative reforms, finds himself in the same situation as Upensky's Russian policeman, who said, quote, "Quickly I seize the rascal by the collar. But what do I see? The confounded fellow has no collar." End quote. And that is precisely Bernstein's difficulty. Quote, "All previous societies were based on an antagonism between an oppressing class and an oppressed class." The Communist Manifesto. End quote. But in the preceding phases of modern society, this antagonism was expressed in distinctly determined juridical relations and could, especially because of that, accord to a certain extent a place to new relations within the framework of the old. Quote, "In the midst of serfdom, the serf raised himself to the rank of a member of the town community. From the Communist Manifesto, end quote. How was that made possible? It was made possible by the progressive of all feudal privileges in the environs of the city. The corvée, the right to special dress, the inheritance tax, the lord's claim to the best cattle, the personal levy, marriage under duress, the right to succession, etc., which altogether constituted serfdom. In the same way, the small bourgeoisie of the Middle Ages succeeded in raising itself, while it was still under the yoke of feudal absolutism, to the rank of bourgeoisie, from the Communist Manifesto. By what means? By means of the formal partial suppression or complete loosening of the corporative bonds, by the progressive transformation of the fiscal administration and the army. Consequently, when we consider the question from the abstract viewpoint, not from the historic viewpoint, we can imagine, in view of the former class relations, a legal passage, according to the reformist method, from feudal society to bourgeois society. But what do we see in reality? In reality, we see that legal reforms not only do not obviate the seizure of political power by the bourgeoisie, but have, on the contrary, prepared for it and led to it. A formal social-political transformation was indispensable for the abolition of slavery, as well as for the complete suppression of feudalism. But the situation is entirely different now. No law obliges the proletariat to submit itself to the yoke of capitalism. Poverty, the lack of means of production, obliges the proletariat to submit itself to the yoke of capitalism. And no law in the world can give to the proletariat the means of production while it remains in the framework of bourgeois society. For not laws, but economic development have torn the means of production from the producer's possession. And neither is the exploitation inside the system of wage labor based on laws. The level of wages is not fixed by legislation, but by economic factors. The phenomenon of capitalist exploitation does not rest on a legal disposition, but on the purely economic fact that labor power plays in this exploitation the role of a merchandise possessing, among other characteristics, the agreeable quality of producing value, more than the value it consumes in the form of the laborer's means of subsistence. In short, the fundamental relations of the domination of the capitalist class cannot be transformed by means of legislative reforms on the basis of capitalist society, because these relations have not been introduced by bourgeois laws, nor have they received the form of such laws. Apparently, Bernstein is not aware of this, for he speaks of, quote, socialist reforms. On the other hand, he seems to express implicit recognition of this when he writes on page 10 of his book, quote, the economic motive acts freely today, while formerly it was masked by all kinds of relations of domination, by all sorts of ideology. End quote. It is one of the peculiarities of the capitalist order that within it all the elements of the future society first assume, in their development, a form not approaching socialism, but, on the contrary, a form moving more and more away from socialism. Production takes on a progressively increasing social character. But under what form is the social character of capitalist production expressed, It is expressed in the form of the large enterprise, in the form of the shareholding concern, the cartel, within which the capitalist antagonisms, capitalist exploitation, the oppression of labor power, are augmented to the extreme. In the army, capitalist development leads to the extension of obligatory military service, to the reduction of the time of service, and consequently, to a material approach to a popular militia. But all of this takes place under the form of modern militarism, in which the domination of the people by the militarist state and the class character of the state manifest themselves most clearly. In the field of political relations, the development of democracy brings, in the measure that it finds a favorable soil, the participation of all popular strata in political life, and, consequently, some sort of people's state. But this participation takes the form of bourgeois parliamentarism, in which class antagonisms and class domination are not done away with, but are, on the contrary, displayed in the open. Exactly because capitalist development moves through these contradictions, it is necessary to extract the kernel of society, of socialist society, from its capitalist shell. Exactly for this reason must the proletariat seize political power and suppress completely the capitalist system. Of course, Bernstein draws other conclusions. If the development of democracy leads to the aggravation and not to the lessening of capitalist antagonisms, the social democracy, he answers us, in order not to render its task more difficult, must by all means try to stop social reforms and the extension of democratic institutions. End quote. Indeed, that would be the right thing to do if the social democracy found to its taste, in the petty bourgeois manner, the futile task of picking for itself all the good sides of history and rejecting all the bad sides of history. However, in that case, it should try, at the same time, to stop capitalism in general. For there is not doubt that latter is the rascal placing all these obstacles in the way of socialism. But capitalism furnishes, besides the obstacles, also the only possibilities of realizing the socialist program. The same can be said about democracy. If democracy has become superfluous or annoying to the bourgeoisie, it is on the contrary necessary and indispensable to the working class. It is necessary to the working class because it creates the political forms, autonomous administration, electoral rights, etc., which will serve the proletariat as fulcrums in its task of transforming bourgeois society. Democracy is indispensable to the working class because only through the exercise of its democratic rights, in the struggle for democracy, can the proletariat become aware of the class interests and its historic task. In a word, democracy is indispensable not because it renders superfluous the conquest of political power by the proletariat, but because it renders this conquest of power both necessary and possible. When Engels, in his preface to The Class Struggles in France, revised the tactics of the modern labor movement and urged the legal struggle as opposed to the barricades, he did not have in mind, this comes out every line of the preface, the question of a definite conquest of political power, but the contemporary daily struggle. He did not have in mind the attitude that the proletariat must take toward the capitalist state at the time of the seizure of power, but the attitude of the proletariat while in the bounds of the capitalist state. Engels was giving directions to the proletariat oppressed, and not the proletariat victorious. On the other hand, Marx's well-known sentence on the agrarian question in England, Bernstein leans on it heavily, in which he says, quote, "We shall probably succeed easier by buying the estates of the landlords," end quote, does not refer to the stand of the proletariat before, but after its victory. For there evidently can be a question of buying the property of the old dominant class only when the workers are in power. The possibility envisaged by Marx is that of the pacific exercise of the dictatorship of the proletariat, and not the replacement of the dictatorship with capitalist social reforms. There was no doubt for Marx and Engels about the necessity of having the proletariat conquer political power. It is left to Bernstein to consider the poultry yard of bourgeois parliamentarism as the organ by means of which we are to realize the most formidable social transformation of history, the passage from capitalist society to socialism. Bernstein introduces his theory by warning the proletariat against the danger of acquiring power too early. That is, according to Bernstein, the proletariat ought to leave the bourgeois society in its present condition and itself suffer a frightful defeat. If the proletariat came to power, it could draw from Bernstein's theory the following, quote, practical conclusion: to go to sleep. His theory condemns the proletariat at the most decisive moments of the struggle to inactivity, to a passive betrayal of its own cause. Our program would be a miserable scrap of paper if it could not serve us in all eventualities, at all moments of the struggle, and if it did not serve us by its application and not by its non-application. If our program contains the formula of the historical development of society from capitalism to socialism, it must also formulate, in all its characteristic fundamentals, all the transitory phases of this development, and it should, consequently, be able to indicate to the proletariat what ought to be its corresponding action at every moment on the road towards socialism. There can be no time for the proletariat when it will be obliged to abandon its program or be abandoned by it. Practically, this is manifested in the fact that there can be no time when the proletariat, placed in power by the force of events, is not in the condition or is not morally obliged to take certain measures for the realization of its program. That is, take transitory measures in the direction of socialism. Behind the belief that the socialist program can collapse completely at any point of the dictatorship of the proletariat lurks the other belief that the socialist program is generally, and at all times, unrealizable. And what if the transitory measures are premature? The question hides a great number of mistaken ideas concerning the real course of social transformation. In the first place, the seizure of political power by the proletariat, that is to say by a large popular class, is not produced artificially. It presupposes, with the exception of such cases as the Paris Commune, when the proletariat did not obtain power after a conscious struggle for its goal, but fell into its hands like a good thing abandoned by everybody else. a definite degree of maturity of economic and political relations. Here we have the essential difference between coup d'états along Blanqui's conception, which are accomplished by an active minority, and burst out like pistol shot, always inopportunely, and the conquest of political power by a great conscious popular mass, which can only be the product of the decomposition of bourgeois society, and therefore bears it in itself the economic and political legitimization of its opportune appearance. If, therefore, considered from the angle of political effect, the conquest of political power by the working class cannot materialize itself too early, then from the angle of conservation of power, the premature revolution, the thought of which keeps Bernstein awake, menaces us like the sword of Damocles. Against that, neither prayers nor supplication, neither scares, nor any amount of anguish are of any avail. And this for two very simple reasons. In the first place, it is impossible to imagine that a transformation as formidable as the passage from capitalist society to socialist society can be realized in one happy act. To consider that as possible is, again, to lend color to conceptions that are clearly Blanquiist. The socialist transformation supposes a long and stubborn struggle, in the course of which it is quite probable the proletariat will be repulsed more than once, so that for the first time, from the viewpoint of the final outcome of the struggle, it will have necessarily come to power too early. In the second place, it will be impossible to avoid the premature conquest of state power by the proletariat, precisely because these premature attacks of the proletariat constitute a factor, and indeed a very important factor, creating the political conditions of the final victory. In the course of the political crisis accompanying its seizure of power, in the course of the long and stubborn struggles, the proletariat will acquire the degree of political maturity, permitting it to obtain in time a definitive victory of the revolution. Thus, these premature attacks of the proletariat against the state power are in themselves important historic factors, helping to provoke and determine the point of the definite victory. Considered from this viewpoint, the idea of a premature conquest of political power by the laboring class appears to be a polemic absurdity derived from a mechanical conception of the development of society, and positing for the victory of the class struggle a point fixed outside and independent of the class struggle. Since the proletariat is not in the position to seize power in any other way than prematurely, since the proletariat is absolutely obliged to seize power once or several times too early, before it can maintain itself in power for good, the objection to the, quote, premature conquest of power is at bottom nothing more than a general opposition to the aspiration of the proletariat to possess itself of state power. Just as all roads lead to Rome, so too do we logically arrive at the conclusion that the revisionist proposal to slight the final aim of the socialist movement is really a recommendation to renounce the socialist movement itself. End of chapter 8.